You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call joins the show for a look at the latest efforts to slow the spread of opioid addiction here in the state. First, it's the week in Washington when we take a look at some of the top stories in national politics. There's still a vice presidential debate scheduled for tonight between Vice President Mike Pence and Senator Kamala Harris. The president, still fighting COVID-19, is back at the White House while staffers around him have also come down with the disease. And we saw the president abruptly extinguish hopes for further coronavirus stimulus measures, then walk back the tweet, and then leave the door open for some kind of economic relief package. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see Congress pass and the president sign some kind of coronavirus economic relief package before Election Day? What does it mean for you? Are you in need of some kind of relief from the federal government? Should there be a big package or bits and pieces? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. Ginger Gibson is Deputy Washington Editor for NBC Digital. Ginger, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, this is a fast-moving story as part of a slow-moving story, this long effort to get another round of recovery package up until yesterday, and the series of tweets from the president. Up until yesterday, Ginger, where were we on this?
So up until yesterday, it looked like Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, and Speaker Pelosi were talking, were trying to come to a deal. And what was surprising for many of us in Washington, it looked like it was possible they could get something done before the election. Normally, Congress just ceases to function this close to an election, in part because normally they're on recess for the month of October, out campaigning, running for their offices. But that all changed when the president started tweeting on Tuesday.
So here comes 1:48, a tweet. The president says Speaker Pelosi is asking for too much. He says that it's a bailout for what he called poorly run Democrat states. And then he says, quoting now, "I have instructed my representatives to stop negotiating until after the election when, immediately after I win, we'll pass a major stimulus bill that focuses on hardworking Americans and small business." So 1:48, it looks like it's done. Nothing's going to happen, right?
It did. The president sort of giving the command to his team to stop talking to Pelosi, to end conversations. We saw the stock market drop almost immediately upon the president sending that tweet, and really try to just bring to a halt the process. And what was a bit of a politically baffling move. I mean, he could have continued to negotiate with them and blame the Democrats for refusing to make a deal. But at that point, it looked like, you know, all on Trump. He's the one who's decided to walk away from the table.
Okay, that's yesterday afternoon. Yesterday evening, 8:54. I think these are Eastern time. Another tweet from the president. "The House and Senate should immediately approve $25 billion for airline payroll support and $135 billion for paycheck protection program for small business." 20 minutes later, he says he'd sign a standalone bill for stimulus checks. So 6 hours have passed now, and it looks like the president's saying, okay, no big deal, but a lot of the parts of it we should move ahead on.
That's right. So that was really something that has been trying to get done in Congress already. And in the previous discussions, we talked about this effort to get a deal. There was some talk. Pelosi had said she would. The House Democrats would approve a bill that just addressed the airlines. There was some talk in the Senate about what they called a skinny bill, some type of really small additional help for people, additional unemployment, maybe a stimulus. And so it looked like the president sort of, after saying stop doing it, then realized that there were things that might have been possible and went back to say, never mind, maybe we should talk about some of these things after all. But it was a bit of a back and forth, all in the president's Twitter account.
Ginger Gibson is with us from NBC Digital, looking at some of the top stories in national politics right now, looking at the still elusive possibility of further COVID-19 economic relief from the federal government. Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Frank is with us in Egg Harbor. Frank, hi.
Hi. I find the president's lack of leadership, consistently bad. So, I mean, consistently lacking. he basically goes with the whim of whatever, six hours later, and the stock market tanks, and people lose money, and, oh, I changed my mind. And then people are depending on these dollars who, in Door County, don't have jobs because of COVID. They lose, you know, Door County, businesses open and close all the time because of the number of cases. There's nothing to count on in this president because he lacks critical thought, any consistency of thought, and I'll take your comments off the air.
Frank, thanks for the call. Ginger, Frank pointed toward Door County, a big tourist destination here in Wisconsin, and the kind of businesses hit hardest by COVID, the tourist spots, the residential vacation places, restaurants, bars, and beyond. Is that something that is on the table for a future maybe paycheck protection program type of thing?
Yeah, we've heard from restaurants. We've heard from trade associations that include tourist type of attractions. You know, it is painfully obvious here in Washington, D.C., how badly the tourism industry has been hit by this pandemic. One need only walk around the city, what is normally this time of year full of school field trips, is empty. I went to the American History Museum. It finally opened last week. I took my daughter on Sunday, and it was, you know, a handful of people. It's a far cry from what it normally is. So I think we're seeing that in Washington, but is it something they're considering? Yes. Do I think that it's imminent? Probably not quite, but if they were to get another deal done, I do think that tourism, the movie theater industry, is another one that's really clamoring for some help, and restaurants and bars.
What has been the response in Congress over the last, 26, 27 hours?
You know, Congress is aware that the public sort of wants to see something happen, that America continues to suffer economically. And we have seen some members who have said they would like to see something get done. Keep in mind, they're mostly not here. The Senate was sent home until October 19th. Senator McConnell's effort to stop the spread of the coronavirus among members of the Senate after three members have tested positive. He's going to need all those members if he's going to get a Supreme Court nominee approved before the election. And so they're not in the building to be working. They're at home, many of them campaigning, but we are hearing from some of them that they would like to see something happen.
Speaking of the Senate, the president in his initial series of tweets there had urged Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, quote, not to delay, but to instead focus full time on approving my outstanding nominee to the United States Supreme Court. So the president saying, set the economic relief aside, go for this Supreme Court nominee. Is there movement on that?
They are continuing to move. So Senator Lindsey Graham, who's in a very tough reelection battle in South Carolina, has set hearings. He's the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, has set hearings for October the 12th. They're still scheduled to happen. But had this coronavirus outbreak not happened among Republicans in Washington, they would have had a much easier time of it. Now they've talking about virtual hearings. They've got members who are sick who are on the Judiciary Committee. They don't want anyone else to catch it. They're going to need all of those members to get the nomination out of committee and to get it approved on the Senate floor. So it has complicated this, but they continue to insist they'll be able to move forward without delay.
We're talking to Ginger Gibson, Deputy Washington Editor for NBC Digital, looking at some of the top stories this week in national politics. As always, lots of them. You can join in at 800-642-1234. You can still weigh in on whether you think Congress should do a big economic relief package or some small ones. And I want to hear what you think about the White House response to a COVID outbreak at and around the White House. What would you want to see the government do differently to try to contain that? Should members of Congress be meeting in person to do things like in the Senate to confirm a Supreme Court justice? Share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about some of the week's top stories in national politics. Ginger Gibson is with us from NBC Digital. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on the possibility of another economic relief package coming from Congress and the president. Should there be more stimulus checks, especially for the long-term unemployed right now? 800-642-1234 is the number to call or email ideas@WPR.org. Ginger, before we move on from this topic, we touched on the airline industry. We touched on maybe relief for restaurants and other businesses heavily affected. How about that idea of direct stimulus payments to some category of Americans? Is that something people are still talking about?
I mean, it's still on the table, and I think that we are still seeing it discussed by leaders, by the White House. The president very much wanted to have checks, particularly ones with his name on it, going out before the election. The time is ticking on that, so I don't know that it could happen before the election. But I do think we could see another round of stimulus payments, especially as we're getting in to the winter. It's starting to get cold, and there's a lot of fear that we'll see another spike or spikes in the virus as people head indoors.
Let's bring on another caller now at 800-642-1234. Kevin is with us in Appleton. Kevin, hi.
Hi, I was just wondering, in the first stimulus bill, I was kind of left out of it because my wife, documented status right now, is going through the process and everything. And I'm just wondering if there's anything in the bill, because I did see Marco Rubio, and I'm not sure of the other congressman that was trying to pass through, trying to get us that were left out of the first bill into this next bill. And I haven't heard too much about it, if it's even being considered right now.
Oh, interesting, Kevin. I haven't followed that closely. Ginger, is that something that you're hearing from members of Congress, people who, for various reasons, were left out of that first round of stimulus payments?
Yeah, Kevin brings up an example of one that I don't think anyone intended to leave people like Kevin out of that first bill. Someone who was married to someone who's a non-citizen, and so the bill meant to not give money to non-citizens and ended up also not giving it to those who were married, to those who were still going through the naturalization or the getting the visa process, which had been delayed by the virus. And so I do think that there's an awareness about that and a desire to not repeat that in another round if they get to another round. But all of this will, you know, stimulus, no stimulus, unemployment, no unemployment, airlines, movie theaters, bars, any of it could come or go until a bill gets signed into law.
Thanks for the call, Kevin. I want to move on to another COVID-19 related story, this time centered at the White House. Ginger, the president himself, of course, a positive diagnosis. Let's start with the president. What do we and don't we know at this point?
So the president, as you said, has COVID-19. He continues to insist that he's doing well, that he's recovered. As I'm sure everyone knows now, it feels like it would have been hard to avoid. He was hospitalized over the weekend, taken on Friday evening to Walter Reed Medical Center, the military hospital just outside of Washington. He received a battery of treatments, pretty aggressive treatments, even as they were insisting he wasn't that sick. He came home at the start of the week. And then this afternoon, we understand he is in the Oval Office. So he's in a matter of days resumed to his office.
Let's bring on a caller. Tom is with us in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi. I'm curious about the lack of contact tracing in the White House. Could you speculate on the reason or multiple reasons why they would not do that? I would assume it'd be something like either general embarrassment, but could it also be not wanting to reveal who might be infected if there's some legislative action with the Senate?
Tom, thanks for the call. There's this growing list, Ginger, of people in President Trump's circle in the White House and beyond. What do we know about if there's efforts to contact trace all of those people?
That's right. So what we're getting essentially is a list of people connected to the president, around the president, who have the disease and who have been public about their positive test results. Aides, advisors. What we don't have is figuring out how it got there. right? This is a man who has the world's best protection and the ability to test every person who comes into contact with him. And he has insisted that he doesn't wear masks because of that. But we now know that even with that, you can catch the virus, especially if you don't wear masks. So we're not seeing the White House engage in the type of contact tracing to figure out where it came from or who gave the president the disease, and then subsequently who the president gave the disease to. Why they won't do that? One might guess the embarrassment factor, figuring out who gave it to him and who he gave it to, and the ability for his opponents to say who he's responsible for having given it to. They say that they don't need a contact trace because everyone who might have come in contact with him is aware that he has it and is aware that they should be following the procedures and getting themselves tested. So that seems to be a bit of it, but I think that there's a lot of people in America who would like to know just how the president caught it.
And we have now the White House and staff there, and people are concerned about Secret Service agents, cleaning crew and more, members of the Senate and congressional staffers. And now the nation's top military leaders quarantining after a Coast Guard admiral had a positive test.
That's right. An admiral, sort of a deputy in the national Coast Guard, had a positive test, and then several of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the guys who run our military, quarantining because they had been in contact with him. You know, I saw this statistic. The District of Columbia on Monday had 13 positive cases. The White House has produced more than that in the last month. I mean, I know Wisconsin has seen a spike in cases. You guys are responding to a bit more spread. Here in Northern Virginia and in Washington, D.C., our numbers are so small right now. The spread has been really reduced. And so this outbreak in the White House is accounting for some of more cases than the rest of the city as a whole at this point.
Talking to Ginger Gibson from NBC Digital. It's our weekly roundup of top stories in national politics. Let's go back to your calls now on COVID recovery stimulus ideas from Congress. Brian is with us in Eau Claire. Brian, hi. Oop, we lost Brian. Let's go to Phil in Mount Horeb. Phil, hello.
Hi. I think that we need to connect the dots on this administration's policy with COVID and the economy in multiple ways. The trade policies, which have devastated our international trade in agriculture, one of Wisconsin's primary industries. I can't understand why farmers are supporting the administration when they've botched that so badly. I also want to point out that we've spent almost $10,000 in the initial stimulus package for every man, woman, and child in this country. $10,000. And if that stimulus, because we lacked the contact tracing and testing capabilities, we weren't able to contain the virus. The tourism industry in Wisconsin, which is, along with agriculture, the other major industry, has been devastated by the inability for people to get out and commingle. The restaurants and bars, you go right down the list. The economic policies of this administration have been an absolute disaster, a debacle for Wisconsin.
Phil, thanks a lot for the call. And Ginger, people are watching these twin issues dealing with COVID-19 and the economic fallout as key drivers in the presidential race. Are you watching for some of those things that Phil brought up there in the month between now and Election Day?
Absolutely. I think Phil has really hit the nail on the head about what calculation we see, particularly undecided voters, doing. Consistently in polls over the last 6 months, we've seen voters say that they don't like how the president has handled the coronavirus pandemic, that they don't feel like he has responded to it adequately, and that more could have been done. However, we have seen polling that shows a majority of Americans still thought he was the best of the candidates to handle the economy. economy, that they thought he had done well with the economy for the next 3 years. And that was sort of Trump's last argument for reelection, was the economy. But we've seen in the last week, especially as we see numbers of people who think that his contracting the virus is just evidence of the handling he's had of the pandemic nationwide, his numbers on the economy have also dropped. We've seen two polls this week that came out that showed the American public no longer believes that Donald Trump is the best to handle the economy. And now they're putting that trust into Joe Biden. The president catching a global pandemic virus the month before the election may go down in history as one of the most consequential October surprises ever. And if the poll numbers don't reverse course quickly as one of the most devastating October surprises ever, we've really seen people who think that it is sort of an indictment on his competency in office.
Just in our last minute, Ginger, preview tonight's vice presidential candidate debate for us.
A lot less interrupting than we saw last week. I suspect it will not be as explosive as the presidential candidates. But we're going to see Kamala Harris and Mike Pence talking about the economy, talking about coronavirus, talking about their visions for America and why they, the number two, 70 something year old president and presidential candidate would do if they were forced to take that office at some point as well.
We'll recap that tomorrow on the show. Ginger, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Ginger Gibson is Deputy Washington Editor for NBC Digital. She joined us today for our weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. Coming up after the news, we talked to Wisconsin's Attorney General about some of the recent moves in Wisconsin aimed at fighting the spread of the opioid epidemic. Still a problem in the state. Numbers looked bad, at least in the latest data going up till last year. Overshadowed in a lot of ways by the COVID-19 pandemic, but it has not gone away as a problem. Wisconsin's Attorney General joins us with more on that issue. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Governor Tony Evers announced a new round of funding aimed at helping the small business community during the pandemic. The head of the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation joins the show with more. First, there have been thousands of opioid-related hospital visits in Wisconsin in recent years. The number increased from 2018 to 2019. The number of deaths from opioids saw a 9% increase in that time. Tackling the opioid crisis has been a goal for top officials in Wisconsin for years, and the state's Department of Justice says efforts involving two recently created prosecutor positions have helped. Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call joins us now. Attorney General Call, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, on Monday, the Department of Justice released a report about the work of these two assistant attorneys general aimed at getting a handle on illegal opioid activities. Give us some of the background of the creation of these positions and the goals.
These positions were created as part of the HOPE legislation that is a series of bills that have passed in the legislature over years. And these two positions in particular are designed to support the work being done by investigators and DAs to fight the opioid epidemic and the drug epidemic more broadly. So these are prosecutors who are based one in Appleton and one in Wausau. We also have a third prosecutor who's based in Eau Claire. And what they can do is work on larger scale cases by working with investigators as those cases work their way up the chain and working with DA's offices so that we can target large scale traffickers of the most dangerous drugs for investigation and prosecution.
Can you talk about how the nature of the opioid crisis has changed? I know in some years past, the focus, a lot of it has been on legal medications used illegally in many ways. It sounds like you're saying it's moved beyond that now in many ways.
There has been a shift in the nature of the epidemic. We've seen decreasing prescription volumes with opioids. That's an encouraging sign. It means that there are fewer people who are likely to become addicted in the long term. But we have also seen an increase in illegal opioids, including heroin and fentanyl. And those drugs are particularly dangerous. Fentanyl is extremely potent and has been involved in a number of overdose deaths. So working to dismantle organizations that traffic those illegal drugs is one of the things we need to be doing to fight the epidemic as we're currently facing it.
Can you describe what these organizations, these trafficking organizations, look like in Wisconsin?
Well, usually these trafficking organizations span not only across states, but across countries. And as illegal drugs come into the state, they're then distributed at an individual level. So what we want to do with these investigations is work our way up the supply chains so that we can cut off the supply of those drugs higher up the chain and stop them from coming into our communities. One thing I want to emphasize about fentanyl in particular, though, is first, it's extraordinarily potent. But secondly, it's often used by mixing it with other drugs. And so in some cases, people think they are using one illegal substance, but it also includes fentanyl. And so people may not realize the danger of the product they're taking. It's one of the reasons people need to seek out treatment if they're struggling with substance use disorder.
With these new prosecutorial positions, what kind of things do you see them having accomplished?
There are two big things that these positions allow us to do. One is, as I mentioned, it allows investigators to work on longer-term investigations where we work those cases up the chain of supply. Our DA's offices are understaffed, and although there were additional positions provided recently, they're still often responding to cases that have been brought to them from investigators. These additional positions allow for a more focused effort on long-term investigations where we're going after the large-scale traffickers. The other thing is these folks are able to bring expertise in prosecuting these cases in particular. And one of the types of cases they work on are what are known as len bias homicide cases, reckless homicide cases where somebody distributed drugs and that caused the death of another person. They are able to bring their expertise so that those cases are handled professionally and that justice is able to be achieved in those cases.
On a concrete level, has this led to more successful prosecutions of those two kinds of cases?
I think it has, yes. And there are dozens and dozens of cases that these regional prosecutors have worked on. You know, the drug epidemic is a massive problem, and there are a lot of things we need to be doing to fight it. Not only holding accountable drug traffickers, but also holding accountable pharmaceutical companies that engaged in false and deceptive marketing practices, investing in treatment, and also investing in prevention and education so that people don't become addicted. But this is, in my view, an important piece of the puzzle as we work to fight this epidemic.
Talking to Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call about efforts to stop the tide, to turn the tide against opioid addiction here in the state. And you were just mentioning, I've heard a lot of people from law enforcement and treatment and beyond saying we can't just prosecute our way or arrest our way out of these problems. Are there things we're doing here in Wisconsin or could do for the drug users, the people who are addicted, to help them get into treatment before they find themselves in the criminal justice system?
Yeah, I think there's a lot we could be doing on that front, and that is also a very important component of the fight against substance use disorder. And we've seen the impact that isolation and that mental health challenges can have in exacerbating the problem we face as we've been dealing with this pandemic. We've seen an increase in people who are dealing with mental health struggles and an increase in overdoses. So there are a number of things we can be doing. One is making sure that people who are struggling with substance use disorder have access to treatment is critical. Right now, we just don't have as many treatment options as we need to have to provide the services that we should be providing. Secondly, if people end up in the criminal justice system because of an addiction, trying to divert those cases so that people are able to get treatment rather than end up incarcerated if the key problem is an addiction, is another important step. And one thing we can do to help more people get access to treatment is to expand Medicaid, which would provide health insurance coverage to tens of thousands of additional Wisconsinites.
I've talked to some of your predecessors in the Attorney General post about things like drug drop-off campaigns where people can dispose of their prescription drugs to make sure they don't get misused. Is that something we're still doing here in Wisconsin?
It is, and we have another drug take-back day coming up soon, and we encourage Wisconsinites who have unused and unwanted prescription drugs to take advantage of that opportunity and to return those drugs safely to a drop box. One of the ways that people can become addicted is by using prescriptions that were prescribed for somebody else that may be left in a medicine cabinet unattended to. So by disposing of those unused medications properly, you can help keep people safe in Wisconsin.
Do you worry that we're taking our eye off the ball when it comes to opioid addiction, given the very real problem of the COVID-19 pandemic capturing a lot of our public health and media attention right now?
Well, I wouldn't say that we're taking our eye off the ball, because I think people continue to recognize how important it is that we continue fighting this epidemic. But I would say that the pandemic has exacerbated this problem, because as more people are isolated, they don't have the kind of social interactions that they would normally. We've seen that impact people in a number of ways, including increasing substance use disorder. And what this does is it's a reminder of the importance of working to fight the drug epidemic, working to get people the treatment and the support that they need.
There have been lawsuits against some of the pharmaceutical companies involved in that. What is Wisconsin's role in that, if any?
I think a key part of fighting this epidemic is to get accountability from pharmaceutical companies that engaged in false and deceptive practices that contributed to the epidemic. That's the right thing to do, because they should be held accountable. But it also is going to help get the state resources that we can invest in things like treatment and prevention and education. We filed suit last year against Purdue Pharma for its role in this epidemic. They declared bankruptcy, but that case is ongoing. And we also joined multi-state investigations into opioid distributors who also have been alleged to have played a role in this epidemic.
In our last few moments, what are you looking to as next steps in combating opioid addiction here in Wisconsin?
Well, one of the key steps is the one you just mentioned, which is holding pharmaceutical companies accountable so that we can bring resources into the state of Wisconsin, but also continuing to expand treatment and diversion programs so that people who are struggling are able to get the help that they need, and then continuing to invest in the kind of long-term investigations and prosecutions of high-level traffickers that can disrupt and dismantle drug trafficking organizations. I think those are all key parts.
Attorney General Call, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Josh Call is the Attorney General for the state of Wisconsin. He joined us today to talk about the Department of Justice's work aimed at stopping the flow of illegal opioid drugs in the state. Next, we talked to the Secretary of the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation about a new round of funding aimed at helping small businesses affected by the pandemic. That's coming up next here on the Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show, take care of your trees. An arborist joins the show with advice on tree care in the fall and how to get ready for the winter. It's tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, Governor Tony Evers has announced that an additional $100 million will be used to support businesses impacted by the pandemic. That includes things like restaurants, taverns, salons, and other types of services. This comes on the heels of the governor's new order restricting gatherings to 25% of buildings' capacity, which is expected to impact businesses already in vulnerable positions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a small business owner or employee? What would you need to help you keep the lights on? Is this too little, too late? How else do you want to see state and local officials pitching in to help businesses affected by the pandemic? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Missy Hughes is Secretary and CEO of the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, or WEDC. Secretary Hughes, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, spell out, please, the basics of this program aimed at helping these businesses hard hit by the pandemic.
So we've got over $50 million worth of CARES Act funding that we're going to distribute in $5,000 grants to over 10,000 businesses around the state.
And how will they apply for that? How are they? How do they know if they're eligible?
Yeah, so applications will be open on October 19th. This is for Wisconsin-based for-profit businesses that have less than $1 million in annual revenues. So those small businesses that, as you mentioned, have really been impacted by COVID-19. And for businesses that are listening, you'll be able to find information about this at revenue.wi.gov.
And I've seen the number $100 million floating around. You mentioned $50 million in CARES Act grants. What's the other money about?
Yeah, so the CARES Act funding that WEDC will be implementing is that $50 million. But we also have $20 million for the lodging industry. You know, as your listeners know, the hotel and motel and inns of Wisconsin have been really impacted by less travel and, you know, folks staying at home. We've got $15 million for live music and performance small venues. So, you know, again, these places that are so critical to the fabric of Wisconsin's quality of life, but just haven't been able to be open due to the restrictions around COVID. And then finally, we've got $10 million for privately owned movie theaters. Every little town has, you know, a movie theater where you can go on Saturday night, and we want to make sure that those are able to endure and survive past this also.
Now, the overall number here sounds pretty big, but $5,000 for a business to stay afloat, and they've been hurting for 6 months now. Is that enough to make a difference?
You know, $5,000 is for these small businesses, it will make a difference. It'll help them pay rent. It'll help with, you know, additional purchases of PPE. It's probably not going to save businesses, but from what we're hearing from businesses, it will really help.
Yeah, could you talk some more about what you're hearing from businesses and communities about, you know, the potential for just big holes to be left in the Wisconsin economy?
Well, what we've really been hearing from businesses is, look, I made it through the first 6 months, but another 6 months of this is going to be really hard for me to survive. And, you know, as we look at the connection between public health and economic health, we have to realize that doing the right thing of social distancing, staying home if you're not feeling well, wearing a mask is what is going to ultimately save these small businesses. So it's really important that we see that connection and we act on it. As individuals and as communities, we're all in this together, and we've just got to do what's right by these small businesses.
Now, this funding comes as we have new restrictions or restored restrictions in some cases for local businesses. Some of the ones we're talking about here, capacity limits for restaurants, bars, and some other indoor businesses. Are you worried that those restrictions are going to be helping some of the businesses that these grants are trying to help?
Yeah, I mean, it's a real challenge that, you know, some of these businesses are aware these gatherings are happening, but it's a short-term pain in order to be able to get through this and to help the overall economy start to recover. We just have to do what we can right now to control the spike of cases that's really affecting our hospitalization rates and really affecting our workforce. These are the steps we have to take right now.
We're talking to Missy Hughes, Secretary and CEO of the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, or WEDC, looking at some new funding from the state aimed at helping some of the smaller businesses in Wisconsin hardest hit by the pandemic. Secretary Hughes, stepping back a little bit from the close-up details here, from your vantage at WEDC, how is Wisconsin's economy and job scenario looking to you right now?
You know, we've been doing our best to recover. The Wisconsin businesses are amazingly resilient and have, you know, stuck through this. It has always been a concern of ours and the governor's that a second surge or, you know, this spike in the fall would be really hard on our businesses. And so from my vantage point, I'm optimistic, but I'm definitely concerned and feel that it's really important that we do everything we can right now to stop the spread of the virus.
And I saw on your website there's a contest for businesses to highlight their creativity in working amidst the COVID-19 pandemic. What kind of things are you looking for?
Oh, thank you for mentioning that, Rob. This is a contest to help celebrate all the solutions that have come forward during this time of COVID. So, you know, whether it's someone who has discovered a way to disinfect PPE or a way to do carry out food more efficiently or touchless, these are the kind of solutions that we want to celebrate because Wisconsin has just a ton of ingenuity. And these ideas are really what's going to help propel us into the future. Startup businesses are where jobs are created. So we just wanted to lean into our innovation muscle and make sure that we're celebrating it.
Do you have specific businesses you would point to that have done some of the things that would fit the bill for this contest?
Well, I mean, everybody's been innovating, right? We're all learning how to do work online or to online school. We've got businesses that pivoted from brewing beer to making hand sanitizer or making masks. So there's just been a ton of innovation, and I would be in trouble if I didn't mention that more information about this contest can be found at wisconsininnovates.com.
Now, getting back to the grant program that we started out talking about, when should business owners get out there and apply for this?
The applications will be open on October 19th and close on Monday, November 2nd. This is for the $50 million. It's an open enrollment process, so you don't have to feel like you need to be there on, 9 a.m. on October 19th. You can fill out the application anytime in that two-week period.
Apart from this cash help, are there resources out there for business owners thinking, I want to stay open, I want to innovate, but I could use some suggestions, some helpful opinions from others? Are there resources available in Wisconsin for those, I guess, kind of questions?
Yeah, Wisconsin has an amazing network of support, whether it's local economic development folks or the chambers of commerce. We have small business development centers at all of our UW system campuses. So there's a ton of resources, technical assistance, and things like that, or even just your bank. If you are a small business working with a bank, you can talk to them about what kind of resources might help you move forward. So definitely reach out. Those organizations have been critical in helping our main streets stay afloat and find those creative ideas. So they're really great resources.
And as we wrap up briefly, a lot of people are watching Washington, D.C. to see if Congress and the president will have any kind of new round of help, especially for the kind of small businesses we're talking about. Do you have any hope? Are you holding your breath for anything like that to happen?
I am an optimistic person, and I believe that, the folks who represent us, especially our federal delegation here in Wisconsin, will continue to advocate for us. We're talking to them all the time. And, I can only believe that something will come through. It'll be bumpy, but we'll get there.
Secretary Hughes, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Rob.
Missy Hughes is Secretary and CEO of the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. We talked to her about a round of grant money for small businesses hurt by the pandemic. It's coming from the state and funded in large part by federal CARES Act money. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the scheduled vice presidential debate tonight has some last-minute safety precautions on the way. We'll look back at the event and what, if anything, it's going to mean in the long-term presidential campaign. Also, there's been a long-running debate here in Wisconsin and around the country about endangered species protections for the gray wolf. We'll find out what the state DNR is looking at doing after those protections come to an end. And dating can be tough enough in normal times. During a pandemic? Wow. We'll find out what it takes to start up a relationship in the middle of social distancing, and you could share your stories. You can start now if you have a pandemic dating story. Email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. Or if it's a short story, tweet us at Central Time WPR. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Here's an update on the election news I shared with you yesterday about penguins and bears. As I mentioned, the New Zealand National Aquarium has been taking votes for their Penguin of the Year. Voting is closed now. A winner is expected to be announced on Friday. But we do have a winner in the brown bear contest I talked about. This is the Fat Bear Week champion from Katmai National Park and Preserve in Alaska. As reported in the Anchorage Daily News, the winner is the bear known as 747. He has been a runner-up in years past. He took the top spot this year. The brown bears do a lot of work fattening up this time of year in preparation for the cold Alaskan winter when they hunker down in their dens. And 747 has been doing apparently a great job of it this year. Some park staff say he may be the biggest bear they've ever seen at the preserve. His description, quoting here from the park website, a very large adult male with wide-set peg-like ears and a blocky muzzle. In early summer, his reddish-brown fur sheds in a patchy manner. In late summer and fall, he's typically very fat with a low-hanging belly and uniformly dark brown fur. 747's weight comes in at an estimated 1,400-plus pounds this time of year. I know I shouldn't use that as an excuse for extra snacking myself before winter, but maybe just a little. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.